The honeybee population has been falling by alarming rates. Today we'll look at why and what is being done to save them. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk about a local effort to save the honeybee by the Low Technology Institute. Its founder and director, Scott Johnson, is with us today. Hi, Scott. Are you there?
I am. I hope so.
I hope so, too. Well, we can hear you loud and clear. And with them is one of the beekeepers that is working on the bee breeding effort, Paul Zielinski. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
What would you like to know about this study? Do you have questions or comments about honeybees? Well, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, Scott, let's start off by talking about the Low Technology Institute. How did it get started, and what's it all about?
Well, that can be a pretty long story, so I'll try and keep it somewhat succinct.
Elevator pitch.
So we're a 501c3 research and educational nonprofit located about 25 miles south of Madison in a historic village called Cooksville, one of the oldest extant 1850s villages around. And anyway, our main goal, our tagline is housing, clothing, and feeding ourselves in a fossil fuel-free future. So basically, we all admit or hope that fossil fuels eventually won't be part of our lives. And so we're just looking for ways that we can take care of ourselves now so that when that happens, we'll be a lot more comfortable than if we just allow things to crash. I'm an archaeologist by background, so I've been looking at the rise and fall of large-scale complex societies for most of my career, which started in academia. And then when I transitioned out of that, we talked about homesteading and raising a lot of our own food and taking care of ourselves. And I thought, you know, I want to do research. I want to work with other people. I want to share what we're doing. And the Institute kind of grew out of that. So we have a lot of irons and a lot of fires, and beekeeping is one of them.
Okay. Well, and how are you funded?
So this specific study is funded by the Blooming Prairie Foundation, as well as a couple different businesses around the area and from across the country that have donated some funds to help us get going. We also work with a local prairie seed company called Agricole. They actually host our study and pay us for pollinating their crops. If you're ever out looking for a place to drive on a weekend, driving through Agricole right now is great because they have rows and rows of wildflowers. It's really beautiful.
Ah, and where is that?
That is about 25 miles south of Madison also. It's just outside of Cooksville.
Oh, okay. So you're nice and close then. Great.
Three miles.
Now, as you had mentioned, that one of the research projects is the bee breeding program, which is the main project that we're going to be talking about today. Tell us basically what you're doing.
So we are taking a method that has been used in other parts of the world to breed mite-tolerant bees, or hope to at least. And so a little bit of, I'll try and keep it short, but a little bit of background is that there's a mite called the Varroa distur, or the Varroa mite, or just mites, that attach onto the bees. They get into the larva and they weaken the hive and the individual larva both together. They transmit disease, and they're one of the leading causes of colony collapse disorder, which is kind of an umbrella term for many pressures that the honeybees are trying to work through right now. And so I like to use an analogy with cows because we're in Wisconsin. So if you had a herd of cows and 90% of the cows were susceptible to a certain disease, you wouldn't breed those cows, right? You would breed the 10% that are resistant and repopulate your herd that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what we're trying to do. The difficult thing is, well, there's a couple different difficulties, but the main difficulty is, you know, breeding a cow is very easy. You have your heifers that you want to breed in the pen with the bull or artificially, however, and that's it. Whereas a queen bee is not a cow. She gets she hatches out of her out of the pupal stage, and she is then a virgin queen. And after a few days, she flies out of the hive to what's called a drone congregation area. And we don't really know how the bees know where these locations are, but think of them like a beach or a nightclub or whatever you want. But if you bring a new colony to an area, the drones or the male bees will know exactly where that drone congregation area is somehow. And all the drones, the males, wait there. The queen flies by, or the virgin queen flies by, and all the drones chase after her, of course. And instead of stinging her, they, impart their genetic material. I'll keep it clean as we can. And
we get your point.
She'll mate with up to, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 drones. And so most of the bees in the colony, the worker bees, they're all half sisters. They share the mother, but have different fathers. And so we can't at home do artificial insemination of the queen. It's just too complicated. So maintaining that genetic, that genetic selection for tolerant or survivor bees is very, very difficult. So what we've had to do, sorry, I kind of have to explain all that background to kind of
No problem.
So,
we have time.
Oh, great. So we've isolated ourselves out at Agricole, and basically we'll have up to 60 hives, and they'll be more or less a closed genetic population, or if we have some outside genetics, we're going to have more bees. So we'll have the majority of the pool. And over time, essentially, what we do is we let the bees that cannot survive with the mites die out, and we breed up the survivors. The reason that this is not done commercially is that it's going to take potentially, on the best case scenario, 3 years, but more like 5 to 10 years for this to stabilize and our population to recover. And that's just not economically viable for most beekeepers, either backyard beekeepers or commercial beekeepers.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do is develop methods to show other people how to do this in an economically viable way.
Okay. Maybe. Yeah, that's always the key, isn't it? Well, Paul, you're one of the beekeepers that's involved in this project. How did you even get involved in beekeeping?
Well, I just was kind of interested in bees for a long time. And my dad had bees back when I was a kid, just a few hives for a while. So when we bought a house out in the country and actually had some space, I decided to get a couple hives. And so I got just a couple hives, and they did well. And so then the next year I split those into a few more, and that just kept happening until suddenly I had more hives than I knew what to do with.
Okay, then. That's the way it starts, right? It's like an addiction. And
exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so then you're a beekeeper. How did you get involved in this research project with the Low Technology Institute?
So Scott and I met at the Dane County Beekeepers Association meetings.
Okay.
So there's quite a robust group of people that meet in person and also have a listserv, madbees.org, if anyone's interested in finding it, the Dane County Beekeepers Association. And it's a great group of people who kind of share ideas and discuss things, and there's a lot of differing opinions on how things should be approached. had a lot of opinions in common and kind of had a very similar philosophy as to where sort of beekeeping should be moving and what we can try to do locally to try to encourage that type of thing. So we met there and we just kind of hit it off. And when he said he was working on this project, I was more than happy to get involved.
Okay, great. Well, we're talking about bee breeding and colony collapse disorder and honeybees in general. If you have any questions or if you have comments about this, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send us an email. That's ideas@wpr.org. Now, there has been some successful attempts to eliminate this problem in other countries. How is that going? What are they doing there? Why is it successful? Scott, do you want to take that?
So, sure. Probably the earlier, well, there's a couple different places that this has happened. One's in Africa, one's in an island in the Baltic, and then in Wales are the ones I like to talk about. The African one I think is really interesting and instructive because, so, you know, my background is archaeology and anthropology, and so I've lived in Mexico and other less developed areas. And what happened essentially in Africa is when the Varroa mite came in, and this is a simplification of the whole complex sort of story, but basically the Varroa mite came in and chemical treatments that we use here in the U.S. Weren't available or were too expensive. And so a lot of beekeepers lost a lot of their bees. Well, of course, the survivors could genetically or behaviorally or some combination of those, they could survive with low levels of the mites, and they bred those up, And now there are, you know, significant populations in Africa that are varroa mite resistant.
Okay.
Now, and we say resistant, it's not that they get rid of them, it's just that they can suppress them.
Right, right. Yeah. Paul, did you have any of these, did you have colony collapse problems in any of your hives?
Well, that's an interesting question. So originally I didn't, and I did very well the first, number of years that I was keeping bees. And then in the last few years, I've actually started to run into things that look like colony collapse. I always find it somewhat difficult terming things colony collapse and attributing it to colony collapse mm-hmm. because colony collapse is actually not a very well-defined, it's not a specific disease. It's more of a syndrome or an umbrella that the symptoms can fall under.
Okay.
And to me, that's what kind of makes it interesting is that a lot of things and a lot of causes for lack of survival can be attributed to colony collapse. But again, there isn't really a very good scientific, here's the, microbe that causes it, or here's the situation that causes it. And to me, it seems like it's kind of a mixture of mites, diseases, poor nutrition, and questionable management styles. So luckily I had been pretty immune to it. And then recently it does seem to be kind of showing up in some of my hives. And that's why I'm very interested in figuring more about how we can avoid it and what can be done to contain it and control it.
Okay. So you had mentioned earlier that the larger companies are dealing with this with chemicals. What problems does that cause when chemicals are being used in hives?
So for treating for mites, there's a wide range of chemicals, and some of them are more damaging than others. And the majority of beekeepers are using chemicals to treat the bees. And originally when beekeepers first started dealing with varroa mites in this country, they were using things like Kumafos and some of these very harsh chemicals. And those were shown to build up in the comb and cause problems with fertility of the queens and fertility of the drones. And it also, after an amount of time, the mites began to become resistant to these things. None of these chemicals kill 100% of the mites. They always have a 90%, 5% success rate and things like that. So in ways, you're actually selecting for the mites that are resistant to these chemicals. And so they kept switching different chemicals. Many beekeepers now, at least the sort of local backyard beekeepers, are using what people refer to as the softer chemicals, such as formic acid, thymol. My preferred treatment, and I do use treatments on my personal bees, is thymol, which is an extract from thyme. So it's completely natural. It's actually the active ingredient in things like Listerine.
Okay.
So I'm much more comfortable putting that in my hives than a lot of the commercial beekeepers use things with the same chemical compounds as things like Tactic Ant Killer, which apparently are very effective on mites, but I worry about the long-term consequences on the hives and on the bees themselves. It just doesn't seem to be a great idea, in my opinion, to put a bunch of insect killer in a box full of insects.
I can understand that.
And can I add that even people who treat, most people don't want to treat. We all want the same thing. We all want our bees to survive. And I totally understand people who treat, every year, every hive. I understand where that impulse is coming from, because you don't want your bees to die. And if you can do anything to save them, you will. But genetically, this is allowing all the genetics to get through. So those that, let's say you have 10 hives, maybe one of them has some sort of natural propensity to be resistant, but you treat them all, you're not really selecting for the best genetics. And so sometimes in beekeeping circles, we get at loggerheads between the treatment people and the non-treatment people, and the treatment people worry that the treatment-free people are just letting their bees, spread mites everywhere, and the treatment-free people are afraid that the treatment people are putting too many chemicals. So it's kind of a debate within the beekeeping community. And so, we all want the same thing, bees that we don't have to treat that live. And so we're trying to do it through selective breeding mm-hmm. rather than, treating hives.
Okay.
Right. So if you look at beekeeping in general, there's a lot of, if you ask, there's kind of an old saying, if you ask 10 beekeepers, you'll get a dozen different answers. So everybody has different ideas. And there's actually been a surprising lack of scientific research on beekeeping over the decades. People have been keeping bees for, you know, hundreds of years, and there's a lot of sort of old wisdom and a lot of communal knowledge, but some of that is fairly wrong, or it doesn't evolve well and adapt well to these new stressors that the bees have. America also has a very unique system of beekeeping with the migratory beekeeping. They say something like 60 to 80% of all the bees in America end up in California in the almond fields in February. So we've got this huge commercial migratory beekeeping system that selects for very different traits than a local Wisconsin beekeeper might be looking for. We don't want our bees to be building up in a very strong hive in February. That's our coldest month, and that's really hard on our bees. But if you're trying to pollinate almonds in February, that's when you want your hive to be at its strongest. And we have a package bee industry that these commercial beekeepers sell bees, so when people's bees don't survive, you can buy new bees. And they come from these warmer states. And so there's this mixture of, as Scott says, sort of these differing goals that different beekeepers have, and the genetics for one area might not be the same that you would be looking for another, not to mention the transmission of disease across the country.
Sure.
Things like that.
Okay. Well, we're talking about bees with Scott Johnson, the founder and director of the Low Technology Institute, and Paul Zielinski, a beekeeper working on the bee breeding project with the Institute. Our on-air producer today is Laura Pavin, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. After 11:45, we'll go from talking about bees to talking about butterflies. That's next on the Ideas Network. But right now we have a caller who has a question for you, gentlemen, Diane in Stoddard. Hi, Diane.
Yes, hi. I was out in my rose garden the other day, and I noticed this huge, it was a wasp. And she must have been about 2 to 2.5 inches long, very multicolored. And she had dug holes and picked out granulars of dirt and was going in and out. We looked on the internet, and it was referred to as a killer bee, a killer wasp. Are you aware of those?
Which one of you guys want to handle that one?
So I can give a start. Maybe Scott remembers more. I was just trying to think. So there are no killer bees in Wisconsin. So you can be comfortable that the bees in Wisconsin, generally the term killer bee refers to the Africanized bees. And again, it's still somewhat sensationalized. But there was an attempt to have bees that were more adapted to producing honey in Brazil, where they crossed European honeybees with African honeybees. And those bees ended up being quite aggressive. And down in the south and the southwest, they can actually form hives and live fairly. And they will sort of attack in mass and sting people and cause some severe problems. In Wisconsin, the winters kill off those bees, so you don't have to be worried about that. Now, that wasp, I've seen those, and actually I was just admiring one of them in my driveway that was digging holes in our gravel. So what those are, I forget, they're called like spider killer hornets or something like that, and it's slipping my mind at the moment. But they actually, those holes that they're digging is where they'll go kill a spider or paralyze a spider and then put it down in the bottom of that hole with an egg, and then that's how they raise new wasps. And they're virtually harmless to people. They obviously can sting, but they generally won't sting and won't cause you any problems. And they can actually be beneficial pollinators as well. So all the local wasps and local bees and things are also very good pollinators. And unless they're causing any difficulties, it's probably best to just watch them and admire them taking care of their business.
Absolutely. Good advice. Would you concur, Scott?
Yeah, and I think there were murder hornets recently in the U.S. press. That's you know, very isolated out on the west coast. And we had a discussion on mad bees, I believe, about whether or not it would survive the winter here with, you know, lots of people talking without any direct knowledge of it because it's far away. So, yeah, rest assured there's hundreds, if not thousands of local pollinators that were here before the European honeybee, which is actually an import, And they do lots of pollination that the honeybees don't do. And so, and some of them are predatory towards bees, but most of them are predatory towards other insects or other things in the environment that, you know, are great for the environment. So,
okay.
Yeah, a lot of those wasps will actually eat the caterpillars of cabbage moths and things like that. And besides doing beneficial pollinating, they will also remove a number of garden pests as well.
All right. Yay. Mm-hmm. Yay for all those pollinator bee wasps. Thank you, Diane, for the question. Let's talk a little bit about what actually happens when you're out there, you're breeding bees. You kind of went over that a little bit, Scott. But Paul, why don't you talk about what you actually do to find these bees that are not susceptible?
So there's been a number of different efforts on people trying to breed mite-resistant or mite-tolerant bees. And we could start with some of those. So there was a breeding project down in Louisiana that had Varroa sensitive hygienic bees. There's a new strain called ankle biters. There's a number of different strains of bees. But our attempt is to try to take so-called normal bees and see if the population of normal bees contains the genetic requirements to come up with mite-tolerant bees. We're trying to make it a repeatable experience for other communities, other areas. So we're actually starting with run-of-the-mill package bees, as it were, and we got a variety of different strains and lines of commonly available package bees. And so we're going to start with that, raise those up, and then use selection pressure of winter here to see if any and those can survive, and then kind of continue breeding from there.
Okay. So when you go out, Scott, did you have something to add?
Oh, I think I was just going to jump in with what you were about to, I think what you were going to ask is how do we physically,
yes,
kind of an idea of what we physically do?
Yeah. So the way that you do that is generally it's better to think of bees in terms of a superorganism rather than an organism. So each individual bee is more of a cell in the organism of the hive than it is its own sort of organism. A worker bee will survive a very short time without a hive to live in. You know, they can't propagate, perpetuate themselves. But each individual hive is more of an organism in itself. And each hive has one queen and then, you know, a number of workers, and they produce drones, and then those can go mate. So the important part for any hive is that queen, because that's where all of the genetic material is coming from. It's coming from that queen and the drones that she mated with. So each year, you can split a hive. So if you have a nice strong hive and you take a portion of that hive, so some of the frames of brood, which are the young larvae of bees in the comb, and you split those off into another hive, they'll sense that they don't have a queen. And if they don't have a queen and they have larvae that are young enough or eggs, they will start raising a queen from those eggs. So all of the worker bees in a hive are female, and bees are haploid diploid, which means that the drones, the male bees, are unfertilized eggs. So they have one set of chromosomes, where the female bees have two sets of chromosomes, and those come from a fertilized egg. So the queen can actually decide whether she fertilizes an egg or not to determine whether it will be a male or a female bee. And so all of those workers have the genetic material to be a queen if they were raised appropriately. And to do that, they feed the larvae royal jelly for its entire life as a larvae before it turns into a pupa, whereas the worker bees only get royal jelly for about 3 days, and then they switch them to bee bread, which is a mixture of pollen and honey. And so they're kind of almost stunted in their development into a worker bee instead of a queen bee by the diet that they're fed. And so the bees will make queens if they don't have a queen in the hive. And by doing that, you can propagate and multiply that hive and have multiple queens and then let them go mate with the drones.
That is fascinating. It really, really is. So detailed. So detailed. Well, we do have another caller online here. Carol is calling from Gutenberg, Iowa. Hi, Carol.
Hi, I'm a small commercial beekeeper from Gutenberg, Iowa, which is just over the Mississippi from you, and I keep about 200 colonies, and I'm always torn between, you know, having to replace my bees with California package bees or California nukes. But anyway, earlier this spring, on some overwintered colonies that I had, one was getting ready to swarm. They had queen cells all over everywhere, and I took it and split it into three. And normally, I would wipe out the queen cells and get some new queens for the what we call nukes. You know that. But I divided it into three, gave the old queen plenty of space to lay, and she is still there and doing well. And the other two pieces hatched their own queens, and they are doing fine. So that, and I had to hold myself back. I always want to cut out queen cells, but anyway. Yeah, I'd like to be a part of your program if you have one.
Yeah, so it's wonderful to hear that you did that, and it's actually interesting because the common knowledge or the old standby is that you should always buy new queens and requeen your hives, and honestly, raising your own queen will almost certainly give you a better quality queen than a purchased queen. Letting them raise those swarm cells, they make nice, big, fat, healthy queens. They get to go mate. They come right back and they get to start laying in their own hive, whereas the commercial queens, they're good quality, but they're mated and then they're put in their cage right away and then they're shipped across the country often. The only downside to raising your own queen is it takes that hive about a month to produce that queen, and so you lose that month of production. And that's why the commercial beekeepers are usually raising queens separately, and then they can, maximize the production and the profit of those hives.
Okay, thanks for the question or the comment, Carol. Appreciate that. Now, she asked if she could be included in your work. Are you looking for more volunteers?
I'll let Scott answer that one.
So, yeah, sure. So, we had planned to, recruit volunteers from, beekeepers in the area who wanted to help us with the actual physical work in the area. COVID has kind of reduced that, so it makes for a lot more work for Paul and me than we expected. So right now we're in the very early stages of this, but later on our goal is to develop potential strategies for small, medium, and large-scale beekeepers to reproduce these efforts and to see how they work. And, one idea for a medium to large scale beekeeper, like the last caller, might be something like setting aside, 20 or 30% of your bees as like a production yard and doing the selection pressure on those while you continue to do your commercial stuff with the rest of them, just so you aren't without income for years that this will take. So that's, a very early idea. And what we kind of want to do, or the goal is to come up with a network of different beekeepers who are trying some of these methods that can help each other with ideas and with problems and troubleshooting. And hopefully we'll build a small online community of people interested in this project. So feel free to send us an email. My email is scott@lowtechinstitute.org. You can also go to our website, lowtechinstitute.org, or just Google for Low Technology Institute and get in contact with us that way, and I'll start building a list of anyone interested in chatting or hearing more about this.
Great, and we do have a link on our program note, so you can go to wpr.org/Larry, and there's a connection right there, too. Thanks so much for that call. You can join in, too, by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we did get an email from Lisa in Menominee Falls. She couldn't, she called. She couldn't stay with us, but she has some natural honeybees that live in her woods and wants to know how to help promote them. What should she do and what should she not do? Scott?
You want to take that one, Paul?
Or Paul?
Sure.
Okay.
Kind of the number one thing to do is to try to not damage those honeybees. So the use of pesticides and some of the neonicotinoids and things like that can be very damaging to those bees, especially if you happen to have any fruit trees spraying at the wrong times when the trees are in full bloom and spraying during the day, things like that. A lot of lawn treatments can be harmful to the bees. So the more you can sort of spread the word to avoid the bee harmful lawn products and pesticides, we'll do a bunch to help those bees. Then, of course, letting some of the native flowers and the wild, you know, flowers and things bloom, maybe mowing your lawn a little less. We have a lot of the Dutch clover, the white clover in our lawn, and that can be very helpful and beneficial to the bees. Other than that, what you could do if you're interested in keeping bees is actually set out what they call a swarm trap, which is basically an empty hive of bees. And then if those bees are feral bees that are sort of naturally living in that woods, they're probably casting swarms, which is how bees reproduce. And I suppose I should define the term swarm. Everyone hears, you know, the swarm, and they think, you know, horror movies and things like that. But swarms are when a hive gets really strong and it outgrows the space that it has. They'll produce a bunch of those queen cells, like the previous caller mentioned, and then the old queen will fly off with half of the bees to try to start a new colony. And that's when you'll see them sort of hanging in the tree, that big ball of bees, and then they look for a new home, and then they'll move into that new home and start a new colony. And that's how hives reproduce. And so if you put out a location in an empty hive, you might be lucky enough to have one of those swarms choose the hive and move in there. And if those are feral bees, that might be a very valuable genetic line of mite-resistant bees that are already been naturally selecting themselves by living in the forest. I know there's one member of the Dane County Beekeepers who's been sort of actively collecting swarms, trying to find feral bees for just that purpose. And he's had reasonable success for the last, I believe, 5 years or so, keeping bees without treating for mites by using some of those feral bee lines to do so.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for that call, Lisa. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Dan in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. What's your question?
This is a very interesting program, and many years ago, I raised bees as a hobby. It was out in the country. They were Italian bees. And, of course, ever since then, now that I've that was back in Ohio, I've moved to Milwaukee and live in a Southside neighborhood that's very much like a suburban neighborhood. You know, and I walk around, and if I spot a honeybee, it's like I've seen a rare dying animal. And so I'm wondering, do people ever effectively raise bees in suburban areas or in within city limits? You know, where the houses are fairly close together. Is that something that somebody can do safely and effectively?
Absolutely. Dane County Beekeepers actually worked with the Madison government, and they passed a beekeeping ordinance specifically permitting people to have bees. And I've kept bees in the city at a friend's house. As long as you have enough space that they won't be a pain to your neighbor. And there's ways to, you can do that on a very small lot by putting things called flyway barriers, which are basically 6 foot tall fences or hedges that sort of force the bees to fly up and over people. You can keep bees right in the city. I know downtown Chicago, some of the hotels even have bees on their roof, and then they serve the honey at their restaurants. Generally, most suburban areas will have plenty of forage and food available for bees. And if you're interested in keeping bees, I would just check your local ordinances to make sure that you're permitted to keep them. And then, by all means, get some bees.
Okay. Good luck, Dan. And
could I add...
Yes.
Can I add in on that to Dan? I used to be an urban beekeeper. I lived in St. Louis in the city and kept bees and did exactly what Paul said, made a flyway to make them fly up in the air and not bother my neighbors. And I will tell you that I know that Milwaukee does have a beekeeping ordinance, and you can keep them. I think you need an application in Milwaukee. But it's a great way. And actually, I found that bees in the cities actually have more forage in some cases than out here in the country. Not at agricole, of course, but out here where I am, you know, there's a lot of corn and soybeans around me, and there's less than there is sometimes in the city where there's clover or lots of ornamental gardens or lots of trees and things like that. So city bees can actually do really, really well.
I've heard lots of stories about bees in New York City, right? On top of the buildings and whatnot.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we've got
and
one
on
more.
Top of the Notre Dame Cathedral.
Oh, that's right. I had heard that too. How cool is that? And let's go to Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm wondering if there's any particular areas of the state that are specifically in bad shape as far as the number of pollinators go. I live in Oshkosh, and I planted something new for my gardening this year. It's called borage or starflower, and it has literally hundreds of blossoms on it. It's supposed to be good for bees. I have a number of plants, and none of them will set seed there, and I've never seen any pollinators. I'm quite concerned. Oshkosh.
So it's actually difficult to say. So the average hive of bees, the foragers from a hive of bees will travel on average about 2 miles. They can travel 4 to 5 miles in a pinch if they really need to get to a source of honey and there's nothing closer. So the old adage is that beekeeping is local, and it is very local. So even if in the Oshkosh area you have commercial beekeepers that might have, you know, 40 hives in one location, if that location is 5 miles away from you, they're not going to come to your yard. So if you want bees in your yard, it's good to have a beekeeper within a couple miles of you to have their bees make it to your garden.
So, Mike, maybe you need a new hobby.
Well, and I was just going to add, if Mike does get interested in bees and wants to keep them for himself, if he can put them a little farther from his yard, it'll actually be better for his own yard. If you've ever watched a bee documentary, you've seen the waggle dance, which is how bees communicate where their different sources of food and water are. And their unit of measure seems to be about 10 yards. And so if you put your beehive right in the middle of a whole bunch of flowers you want them to pollinate, they'll probably fly right by them because they're off going somewhere else. They can't physically say to one another, hey, right in front of the hive, there's a whole bunch of great flowers. It has to be at least 10 yards away.
Wow, that's really good information. This has been such an interesting discussion. I'm afraid we've run out of time. But thank you both for being with us, and good luck with your project.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Sure. We've been talking about bee breeding with Scott Johnson, the founder and director of the Low Technology Institute, and Paul Zielinski, a beekeeper working on the bee breeding project with the Institute. If you want to know more about the Institute, you can go to our website, wpr.org/Larry, and there is a link on our program note. If you want to go directly, it's lowtechinstitute.org. Well, stay with us on the Ideas Network. Up next, we're going to talk to the author of a really interesting new book on butterflies.